was born. Six gun in my hand. Behind a gun, I make my final stand. Hey, it's why they call me Bad Company.
Welcome back. Murder shows, serial killers, we're all fascinated with all of these people who torture people. Why are we fascinated with the most evil people in our society? I represented serial killer John Wayne Gacy in the last set of his death row appeals, and most people have the reaction, Karen, why did you do that? That's disgusting. That's a horrible thing to do. And the next question is, but what was it like? What was he like? What was it like to look into the eyes of evil? Some people, like my guest, though, study evil, and they rank them on a scale to determine who and what acts are the most evil ones on Earth. And by doing so, hopefully creating profiles that we can learn from. Tonight, we have the authors of the book, The New Evil, Understanding the Emergence of Modern Violent Crime. Dr. Michael Stone, professor of chemical psychiatry at Columbia College, physicians and surgeon, author of 10 books, and host of the Discovery Channel's series Most Evil, you may have seen that. And Dr. Gary Brocato, clinical psychologist and researcher in the area of violence, psychoses, assistant director of the Center of Prevention Evaluation and New York State Psychiatric Center. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well.
All right. Thank you. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. The book is a big, thick book, and in it, for people who are interested, it basically details the different categories and the different rankings of the morality and the evil of certain acts. Tell me, Dr. Stone, why did you write this book? What was the purpose in writing the book?
Well, originally, I was interested in personality disorders, and I worked on a unit in Columbia called Psychiatric Institute, where there was primarily borderline people with borderline personality. However, the more I got into it, the more I was occasionally called upon to by attorneys, you know, to decide whether a particular murder case involved or a severe custody case involved somebody who was close to borderline. But as a result, I began to see more people who, besides being borderline, or rather than being borderline, were antisocial, and sometimes even at the far end of the personality spectrum, where they were sadistic and psychopathic. So then I got interested in the topic of evil, because even though it's not customarily written about or even acknowledged very much in psychiatry, the deeds, the terrible deeds that some of the people did that I was called upon, you know, to look at or even to interview some of these people, they were doing things that the average person hearing about it, let alone witnessing it, would say, oh, my God, that's evil. So I began to think, okay, there's many acts then that elicit this emotional reaction from people, oh, my God, that's evil. But some of the acts are even more dreadful and barbaric than others. And so I began to make a scale, especially for the instructing a jury out in California, about where did the particular murder case, a man that had murdered his pregnant wife and his two daughters, where did that fit in the grand spectrum of terrible and also murderous acts?
Dr. Stone, let me just back up just a little bit here. Just for listeners, the issue of personality disorders is something that's very interesting, and we're not going to really go into it in this show, but I highly suggest that you all, at some point, if you're interested, Google the term borderline personality, because a lot of people have a misunderstanding of what that means. They think it's on the borderline of insanity or something, but it's a diagnosis that people have that don't necessarily do evil. There are a lot of people walking around who are borderline personalities, correct? And they don't cross the line of doing evil deeds.
Oh, that's right, of course.
Right.
It's only that by virtue of being, as I say, called upon to just examine and talk about some of these people in law cases, that I began to confront other individuals who were not really borderline at all. They had a personality disorder, but it was a more extreme one involving antisocial acts, including all the way up to sadistic acts and things like that.
Got it. Dr. Brocato, you know, as you know, and I'm going to say this for the benefit of the listeners, the insanity defense in the law is very narrow. People think that it's just anybody who does something that is out of the ordinary or crazy, or what we think to be crazy, is going to get the insanity defense and is going to somehow, you know, have the, you know, not be convicted in a criminal court. But basically, insanity defense is when a criminal suffers from a mental defect that causes him not to be able to appreciate the criminality of his conduct, not knowing the difference between right and wrong. For the people that you outline in this book, for the most part, are these people who don't know the difference between right and wrong?
No, I think one of the really interesting things that one learns when sitting down and looking at cases like this is that the vast majority of these crimes that would be called evil are perpetrated by people who have personalities with proclivities to do things that are sadistic or cruel or horrendous or vicious. And only a small portion of them, for example, among serial killers, it's estimated, for example, we looked at data from the serial killer database, which is kept by, I believe it's Radford and Gulf Coast universities, that over 4,000 offenders meet criteria for serial killing. Only 6% of them showed indications of severe mental illness like psychosis. The vast majority are individuals who know full well what it is they're doing. We do see some individuals where there's an overlap of things like psychopathy, where there are features of the personality that can be psychotic-like. We sometimes see people who are capable of a kind of a detachment from human beings. Like, for example...
you know what, Dr. Brocato, yeah. I'm so sorry, but I got to take a break here. When we come back, I want to finish that conversation. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. We'll be back in a few minutes, and we're going to continue to talk to Dr. Michael Stone and Dr. Gary Brocato, authors of the book New Evil.
You got to change your evil ways, baby, before I stop loving.
We're here with the authors of the book The New Evil, Dr. Michael Stone and Dr. Gary Brocato. Welcome back. Are you guys still there?
Yes, we are.
Hi, thank you. So let's talk a little bit about the spectrum of evil. In your book, you have the various categories. I believe it's from 1 to 22. Is that right?
Yes.
And so can you just, without going through each and every category, like, tell our listeners what the range is from the low end of the evil scale to the very highest end of the evil scale, and maybe mention a few people who our listeners might know and why their acts qualify in those categories.
Well, I purposely chose number one to anchor the scale to differentiate between what was evil and not. So number one is justified homicide, and therefore not evil. But so therefore the first one that's evil is number two, which would be a crime of passion, like when Jean Harris killed the Scarsdale diet doctor when she discovered that he was cheating on her with another woman. That's the lowest element in the scale, the most understandable of things that are wrong, murderous, and yet therefore evil, but only a little bit. Then by the time you get to category 10 or 11, you're dealing with people that, besides having done a terrible act of some sort that inspires the term evil from people, there's also the individual showing a severe personality disorder that we call psychopathic, because they have pathological lying and callousness and lack of remorse, and they manipulate and exploit others. So they have these psychopathic traits that Robert Hare in Canada outlined in his very special 20-point scale some years ago. And then by the time you get to 17 and above, you're dealing with people who've murdered one person after the other, and 17, let's say, would be someone who has committed serial sexual homicide. In other words, he's raped and then killed the person, but hasn't exposed the person to torture beforehand. At the top of the scale, where you have people like David Parker Ray or Gacy, you have people who have committed some measure of torture before finishing the person off, and often with a sexual element, so that there's serial sexual homicide, meaning often rape, then strangling, and sometimes dismemberment and other things that give an awfulness that not only inspire the word evil, but barbaric, atrocious, heinous, and other words at the extreme end of the vocabulary.
Dr. Stone, a lot of times people are very fascinated, and your book does a good job of talking about the backgrounds of some of these people, which, you know, to me is just fascinating. You know, why does this person become what, you know, who this person becomes? And you see people with kind of like okay backgrounds who turn into these monsters, and you see people with, again, horrific backgrounds who don't become evil monsters. So how does a person's background factor into your analysis? I guess I'll ask Dr. Brocato that. Is that something that even gets factored? Are we just looking at the acts themselves?
Well, it's an interesting question. First of all, when we talk about evil in the scale, we're really describing acts. There are some individuals that, very few, but there are some individuals that commit evil with such frequency that we might call the individual evil, but usually we're talking about acts. And what happens is that an individual who commits an evil act, even in the most egregious repeat offender, we typically see a kind of a fragmentation of the personality where the person is capable of, you know, having a seemingly normal life, working, having relationships, so forth. And what's intriguing about these people is that more often than not always, but more often than not, there are horrendous antecedents, horrendous abuse, head injury, family issues like alcoholism, and so forth, that we see in these individuals. There are others, of just a few, that Dr. Stone and I call bad seed. You know, these are people that, just for some reason, by birth, do seem to demonstrate this kind of psychopathic qualities, really from the time they're children. Now, it's important not to get too technical about it, but it is important to understand that there's a distinction to be made between what we call a primary psychopath, which is someone who is simply born with a brain predisposed to do things like that, and someone we would call a secondary psychopath who is so badly treated and experiences such terrible circumstances growing up that they might look like someone with primary psychopathy, and it's often difficult to tell them apart. Now, what we say in the book that I think is a really interesting point for listeners is that it is entirely possible in theory for someone to have a brain that is, you know, by birth predisposed to things like being bored, sensation seeking, being fearless, the kind of thing that would predispose someone potentially to aggression. But because they've had a positive upbringing, positive family structure, they may go into some kind of pro-social job. You imagine someone that fearlessly races into a crime or, you know, works on the side of the law. And it raises the question, I'm just theoretical, of course, but it raises the question of whether you need the additional element of the horrendous life experiences. But, of course, these are all just hypotheses.
Because it's a recipe that we haven't figured out quite yet. Exactly, right?
That's right.
So let's just, you know, I look at the spectrum sometimes, and I wonder, I don't know that you touched on this in your book, but I'm just thinking of Nazi Germany, okay? I'm thinking of the Hitler who comes up with the idea of exterminating an entire race. And then, so let's take Hitler on one side, who's kind of the mastermind of the whole thing. And then let's talk about the doctors who perhaps were performing these horrendous experiments on people in the concentration camps, and maybe they even thought they might be doing good for society because they were learning about all kinds of diseases, but in the process they were torturing these human beings. And then let's take, on the other hand, the soldiers who were told to do this, and then the soldiers were doing it, and they didn't have any problem, morally speaking, at the end of it, with doing it, and would execute people without any compassion. Can you, Dr. Stone, sort of take us through how you would rank the morality of those three people?
Well, first of all, that's a different book. That's the one we haven't written yet.
Okay.
Because you're talking about wartime. And wartime, from the beginning of when there was war, many, 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 many thousands of years ago, people have done unspeakable things to the enemy, even though they may go home to their wife and kitties and have a nice meal and sleep well until the next day. So that's we're talking about evil in peacetime. In other words, in non-gang, non-wartime, non-one social group against another social group clash, we're talking about individuals in peacetime. So that what we know that under situations of war, ordinary people are capable of doing dreadful things to the enemy, and this is. World War II was, of course, an example, but what about the Napoleonic Wars when Napoleon's troops invaded Spain and committed many atrocities against the Spanish people? Some of the Spanish people got together, and they would then capture some of Napoleon's troops, the French troops, and they would squish them between very large rocks and things of that sort. But those were ordinary people who were infuriated by the death of their loved ones and quite capable, even though they were not psychopaths or antisocial or anything like that, of getting back at the enemy. So that's not what we're ranking. We're ranking terrible things that happen in peacetime to people who you would think otherwise should not be inspired to do those kinds of acts.
Got it.
Got it.
We're going to have to take a break. I want to remind you, we're talking to Dr. Michael Stone, Dr. Gary Brocato, PhD. The New Evil, it's a great book, Understanding the Emergence of Modern Violent Crime. If you're a fan of these very scary people, the Donnie Wahlberg series that's going on, you will love this book. It's a lot to read, and it's a lot of background on some of the interesting killers and an explanation of how they're ranked and why they're ranked. We'll come back and we're going to talk a little bit more to the doctors. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're talking to the authors of The New Evil, Dr. Michael Stone, Dr. Gary Brocato. I just want to quickly, I'm going to play some sound bites from some serial killers, some mass murders, and I want to have you discuss with me how you ranked them and why you ranked them the way you did. But before I do, I just have a quick little anecdote. I represented a really bad guy. The really bad guy died, and he never got to see his son, who was born about 3 months after he was killed. The guy was a murderer, and he was a very bad man all around. The little boy grew up in a very nice home with a very nice family, didn't really know much about his dad at all. And when he was about 2 years old or 3 years old, I used to see him with his mother, and I used to see him torture cats, try to hurt animals, try to hurt other people. And he grew up, and as he grew up, I watched him do the juvenile thing, from hurting other children to bullying people to, stealing things. And he's right now in jail. And it's almost like he didn't have a chance. Is that something, when you see that kind of amorality from a young age, what do you make of that? Dr. Either one can answer.
Well, there's two, I think Dr. Bacata has already mentioned that there are some people who have been brutalized to the point where they lose the morality that they might have acquired, you know, from at least one decent parent or some good teachers or the religion, if they had gone to church or temple or whatever. But there are others who are born with a inclination to become not only antisocial, but psychopathic. They do not have compassion and empathy. They may have the ability to recognize if a little kid's crying that the kid is scared or sad, but they don't have the compassion or sympathy that an ordinary person does, oftentimes really from birth, but certainly if they have a good family that they come from. But if occasionally, or in the case of adoption for certain kinds of children, like this fellow Nicholas Cruz that killed the 17 people in Parkland, Florida, he was adopted from a woman who was probably a prostitute. She was drinking. She had the kid had fetal alcohol syndrome, so his brain was damaged, and he became psychopathic, probably. Not because the adoptive family was cruel. They were very, very nice people. But he inherited a predisposition to not be following the rules. And therefore, he did very cruel things all the way from age two. So that the genetic factors as well as environmental factors have to be taken into consideration in these cases.
Okay, let's play some sound bites. Our producer, Ben, can you play the first one from John Wayne Gacy? And this was from an interview with our own Walter Jacobson, the newscaster.
What do I think of Jeffrey Dahmer? I don't know the man personally, but I'll tell you this. That's a good example as to why insanity doesn't belong in a courtroom. because if Jeffrey Dahmer doesn't meet the requirements for insanity, then I'd hate like hell to run into the guy that does.
I love it. John Wayne Gacy on the insanity defense. Oh, there's something so wrong with that. Dr. Brocato, Gacy is in your book. How did you rank him?
Well, Gacy is a Category 22, which is the very top of the scale. And the reason is that when an individual has engaged in repeat murder without the context of psychosis, and there's been protracted torture, prolonged torture, 22 is the required ranking. So that John Wayne Gacy is someone who demonstrated not only psychopathic features across his life, with a lot of the classic behaviors in youth that we would have seen. But you also see an individual who had the ability to deceive individuals, you know, in a certain extent, even fragmented within himself, had a lifestyle where he was sort of keeping a marriage and so forth, and then going out and committing heinous acts of murder, luring people home and using devices to torture them, engage in repeat rape, keeping them, you know, under the house, buried in the crawl space. So that what you see there is an individual engaging in what is necessary for the 22 ranking.
Got
it. The sadistic protracted torture. Right.
Let's move to Charles Manson.
You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. I wouldn't do anything that I felt guilty about.
All right.
You don't feel guilty at all.
There's no need to feel guilty. I haven't done anything I'm ashamed of.
Okay. All right, Charles Manson. Actually, Charles Manson never actually murdered anyone that I know about.
That is not true.
Oh, it's not true.
That is not true. He did murder somebody on that farm that all the young people.
Oh.
He did kill at least one person, probably others.
But the high-profile case of the Sharon Tate murders.
He was a psychopath. He had the genetic. His mother was a prostitute. There were several people in the family line who were extremely antisocial, etc. So he was a psychopath from the get-go. However, in addition, he also suffered a great deal by being raped annually when he was in prison as an adolescent. So he had both factors, the genetic factor and a terrible environment of maternal neglect and then sexual misuse when he was in prison. But the psychopath would say, these things happen to me, therefore I have a right to do anything. Whereas a normal person, even subjected to the horrors of what happened to him in prison, would, after he finally was released from prison, for example, would say, well, boy, that was pretty horrible. I'm certainly not going to do anything like that to anybody. That's awful. And so he imagined that because he was misused, et cetera, that it gave him the right to do unspeakable things to others. But that is the signature of the psychopath.
Let's go to...
We would rank Manson and the followers of Manson, with some exceptions, in Category 15, which is the ranking for psychopathic spree murderers. He's a pretty textbook example of somebody that we would place there.
I know this is a very sick comment, but, and please don't take it the wrong way, but I almost feel like there's like an Academy Awards of killers, right? And the winner and the trophy goes to, but it's just so interesting to even rank these horrible things. But it's interesting because you think about the morality and how bad is bad. Let's go to Eileen Warnes, who, by the way, the Donnie Wahlberg show, I think is showcasing her crimes tonight on his show. Eileen Warnes.
And yet he says in all his conversations with you, he never heard you express remorse. Have you never felt it?
Remorse for what?
Nope, nope.
You people have
done
everything.
We need Eileen. Okay. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Let's go to Berkowitz, son of Sam.
What would you tell 23-year-old David Berkowitz today?
Turn around before it's too late, because destruction is coming, you know. And as far as I'm concerned, that was not me. That was not me. I hate that name. I despise that name.
Which name?
That moniker, Son of Sam. That was a demon.
Eight shootings, killed six, wounded seven. How would you rank Mr. Berkowitz?
Well, Berkowitz was 17, but the thing is, he faked being crazy.
Right.
Because he knew that it was very likely if he had gone to a regular prison that he might be seriously injured by some of the other prisoners, so that he was clever enough to fake insanity, the Son of Sam and all this nonsense, which he once he was in a forensic hospital, which is a much milder place to be than a prison. After some number of years, he did confess to an FBI agent that, you know, I made those stories up. And he was an adoptee who was raised in a very nice middle-class family in the Bronx, but he hated the idea that he was his biological mother was probably, in his mind, a loose woman, you know, who maybe got pregnant by doing hanky-pank with some guy in a car in Lover's Lane. And he had tremendous resentment against loose women that he imagined his birth mother must have been. And so, therefore, he was committing vengeance against all the loose women of the world.
I've got one time for literally like 30 seconds here. James Holmes, one of our texters was asking specifically about James Holmes. He was killed 12 in the Colorado theater and injured 7. Let's do that last one, Ben.
I was mentally ill. We're different from the norm. How else? Being successful with the mission.
I'm not sure we can hear all of that. But how would you categorize him? We just have a few seconds here.
Well, very quickly, James Holmes would likely be Category 13, which is where we would place individuals that have kind of inadequate, somewhat ill personality structures, more like mentally ill individuals who can commit heinous acts of repeat murder in that context.
Thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had more time, and I hope you do come back. The New Evil, it's a great book, Understanding the Emergence of Modern Violent Crime by Michael Stone and Gary Brocato. It can be, you can get it on Amazon and any reputable bookseller. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, and stay out of evil's way, okay? All right.
We promise.
Right. Take care.